Today I'm talking with John Verhoeven, former major league pitcher with the California Angels, Minnesota Twins, and the Chicago White Sox, and currently a pitching coach at Cal State Dominguez Hills, among other things. We want to talk to John about his life and times in the sport of baseball. John, I'd like to know, what position did you start off playing as a kid growing up?
Either third base or pitching or catching. Somewhere where my arm could utilize a little bit of right field.
You said you played in Little League in Long Beach. Is that where you basically spent most of your career? Started Little League down there and then
yeah.
High school and stuff?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I went to... I was born and raised in North Long Beach, and the house I lived in is still, we still own the property, and there's a mobile home park on there now. And I went to high school at Valley Christian High School in Cerritos. It's a private school out there. And, so yeah, I was born and raised in Paramount, North Long Beach area.
Did your high school team, or high school have a team?
Uh-huh.
So you played high school ball right there?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
John, tell me a little bit about your college career.
My freshman year was kind of a learning period for me, and I was against, I had no business probably even pitching in college. And
from there, did you, were you then kind of kicked up in the rotation the next couple of years? You worked with Ipswich, the number one spot there. Is that what took
yeah,
place?
Yeah, going into my sophomore year, I was either number one or number two, and my sophomore year, I went 8-1, and I pitched pretty well. And my junior year, I thought I would try playing basketball on the JV basketball team just to get in shape for baseball. And I was in great shape as far as running was concerned, but I started off the year 0-4. I should have known better and had arm problems again. But I ended up my junior year 9-5, so I kind of turned it around. And after my junior year, I decided to... I had quite a few good games, but there are no scouts there. Santa Barbara doesn't have a whole lot of scouts unless you're, you know, a first, second, third, fourth round draft pick, and I knew I wasn't. So I decided to transfer to Laverne College, where Ben Hine, now starting for the Dodgers, he was a coach. He's been banged around by Laverne pretty good. When I pitched against him, I thought, you know what? If I go over there and join them, I don't have to pitch against them, so that might give me a couple more wins. So I went to Laverne, and there we had a real good team. Nick Leyva was a shortstop, and Dan Quisenberry and I were the two main starters. Had a real good club, and I got drafted on the 12th round that year after going on my 14-1, and got drafted by the Angels on the 12th round.
Do you remember the scout who it was who scouted you for the Angels and I guess it was signed you to the contract?
Yeah, the fellow's name was Dick Winsick, and at the time he was Harry Dalton's assistant with the Angels. And I know he's still in scouting. The last I knew, as a matter of fact, I called him when I got released after the 82 season. I called him. He was with Oakland at the time, and through him I got an invitation to spring training with Oakland. And got cut, got released at the spring training of 83.
So you were basically drafted then in the 12th round by the Angels. That's how you were acquired by them.
Mm-hmm.
Alrighty. What happened as soon as you were signed, coming out of college? I guess you finished your college career. Did they immediately place you with a minor league team? Is that what took place?
Yeah. The draft, they had the draft in June, and then about a week and a half later, I got a call from Larry Himes, who was recently the general manager of the White Sox. And Larry was one of the scouts for the Angels and said, we'll be getting in touch with you real shortly and let you know. There's a chance you might be going to Idaho Falls Rookie Club. And as it turned out, they sent me to Davenport, Iowa, which was a Class A Midwest league.
You started off your career then at Davenport, Iowa. How long did you end up staying in the minor leagues?
I was in that second half of the year. I signed in June, and I played there in 1974.
So you really only spent about a year and a half or so in the minor leagues.
The first time around.
What was it like, John, adjusting from being a starter to the role of a reliever?
Having to make an adjustment, because as a starter I struggled early in the game and I'd usually settle in about the second or third inning. And obviously in relief, you don't have time to settle in. So that was a tough adjustment. I noticed at every level I played at A-ball I struggled early, in double A they were just about ready to send me back to A-ball after a month of the season. And then I adjusted there. AAA the first time, I got banged around a little bit, and ended the next time around.
Like, you were a young guy, maybe away, well, you had been to college, but away from kind of home, you were in some geographic location that was different from home. Was it a fun time for you? Was there a lot? Did you feel a lot of pressure? What was that like for you?
In minor leagues, you don't feel any pressure. I think the guys that feel pressure in the minor leagues are probably the guys that maybe don't have their degree and already have a wife and maybe even have a little family started. And I didn't have that. You know, I had my degree at the end of 74, and baseball to me was what I was my second thing. I was going to be a teacher and a coach, and baseball was just something that I thought, yeah, boy, that'd be great to play. But I was prepared to be a teacher and a coach. So I went down to A-ball and double-A, and I think I finally felt a little bit of pressure is when the pitching coach from El Paso in 75 told my parents, your son's going to pitch in the big leagues. He's definitely going to pitch in the big leagues. And I remember being really excited because no one had ever told me that before. And he didn't tell me. He told my parents. They happened to come into town and watch me play. And I think that's when I finally felt a little bit of pressure, because I remember I went out that night and got shellacked. And then I said to myself, this is ridiculous, you know, that here I got a chance, and now I felt the pressure. I think after that, I got banged around pretty good that night after I heard that.
How would you kind of, I guess, categorize the people that you dealt with in the minor leagues, the front office people, your coaches, managers, things like that overall? Was it a pretty good experience with those people also?
Yeah, it was a real good experience. I played for Jimmy Williams, Jimmy with 1M, who is the Toronto manager. He was great. He was probably the best manager a young guy could ever play for. If you went out as a reliever, his nickname was Captain Hook. You know, he had a real quick hook, and it was great being a young player and being a reliever for him. You know, he's like the best guy I could have possibly played for. You have a bad game, and you can just about bet you're going to be right back in there the next night. He managed to get players to the big leagues. He didn't manage to advance, and that's what was real good about Jimmy Williams. He should have been named the manager of the Angels. He really should have.
Really?
Yeah. There's no doubt in my mind that he should have eventually gotten that job, because if they would have given him the job in the mid to late 70s, you would have seen a lot of the Angel young players that had come up that when they went 0-10 coming up from Salt Lake, instead of being taken out of the lineup or instead of having a bad game in the bullpen and not pitching for 10 days, Jimmy Williams would have managed the same way. He would have managed to get the player to be a bona fide major leaguer, and it would have turned out a lot better for the Angels had they had done that.
What about your pitching coaches coming up? Did you feel that they had the knowledge to help you as a pitcher to really put your career on course, or was it just a hit or miss type of thing?
The only pitching coach I really had in the minor leagues was Chuck Estrada, and in those days, in the early mid-70s, late 70s, not every club had a minor league pitching coach. You know, there was like a roving instructor. He came into town to El Paso for a few days, and then he'd go to Salt Lake. It wasn't like now where the A club and the double A club and the triple A club all have their own pitching coach. You know, it wasn't like that then. And so Chuck would help, but he really couldn't. You know, he would only stay for a week and then he was gone. But he helped a lot with the mental aspect. You know, I think probably the best advice he gave me is, I remember throwing in the bullpen that you're not. Just go out there. If you've got a good sinker, throw the sinker. Don't try to be something else. And the mental aspect, that is where those guys came in handy a lot. My mechanics were pretty messed up and screwed up anyways. And most of the times when a pitching coach sees a guy that throws sidearm and throws across his body and he's getting people out, they just go, man, I ain't going to touch that kid. You know, I'm the same way now. I see a kid throwing that way, and I can help him a little bit because I pitch that way. But if I get some of these left-handers that throw kind of strange, you know, I think, gosh, he's doing a good job. If I show him how to do things right, what's going to happen? I'm just going to leave that kid alone.
How about the front office personnel in the minor leagues? Did you guys have much dealing with them at all during your career, or was it just pretty much they were business and you guys were playing ball?
No, you did. You had a lot to do. But Tom Summers was the farm director for the Angels at the time, and he was a great guy. He was really good. And we negotiated contracts with him. We didn't have agents. And I can remember sitting in there, and I wanted $1,500 a month. And the Angels at the time were offering me $1,300. And I remember, I look back now and I laugh because I sit in the meeting and I'm saying, well, I'm kind of lukewarm about this $1,300. And I remember him saying, hey, you're a little lukewarm about that. Now he goes, well, what would make you hot? And I said, it's just a crack up. If you think back, and it was funny that you asked that question because I just had a call 3 days ago on my answering machine from Tom Summers.
Wow.
And he's an insurance agent in Fresno. And I tried to return his call, and he wasn't in. But it was funny because the message he left sounded the same. He goes, the message was this time, he goes, now that you're not a ball player anymore, he goes, you may call me collect. And he had the same voice that I heard about 100 times trying to squeeze another $100 out of him.
How about the fans? You mentioned you played in Iowa and in El Paso, Texas, and then in Salt Lake City. How were the fans to the ball players? None of those towns were that close to any real major league city. So did they treat you guys a little bit special?
Well, if we were winning, yeah. If in Salt Lake we had real good clubs, we had real young teams, and we won our division usually, and fans really came out. We probably averaged 2,000 or 3,000 a game, and everybody knew who the Gulls were, you know, because we were winning. In Iowa, I played on some last place teams, and we got beat up, and we were known as the Iowa Jokes instead of the Iowa Oaks. And you know, there it was just like, you know, it all depended. It just all depends whether you were winning or not. El Paso, we were probably a 500 ball club, but in El Paso, the minor league operation over there was just getting started, and it was really interesting. And Dudley Field had a lot of character to it, and we had a PA announcer who I believe is still there. I ran into a kid from El Paso and asked him if Paul Strelzin, the PA announcer, is still doing it. Jim Paul still owns the club, and he said, yep, they're still doing it. And I said, when you get over there, say hello to them. And, I mean, these guys were crazy. They would chant during the game and on the PA system. But I understand they're not at Dudley Field anymore.
Yeah, there's been a new field, I believe, built down there for one of the state-of-the-art new minor league fields.
Yeah.
I think it was recently highlighted in National Geographic. They did a special about the some of the minor league teams.
At old Dudley Field, there was a zoo in right field, beyond the right field fence. And I remember when Willie Akins would come up, the elephant's name was Ak-Ak. And Paul Strelzin would get on the PA system whenever Willie would get up, and as it turned out, Willie's nickname was Ak-Ak because he'd hit the ball over that right field fence and hit it into the zoo. And so whenever Willie would come up, Paul Strelzin would warn Ak-Ak on the PA system, watch out, Ak-Ak, run for cover. This crazy thing, he had nicknames for everybody. A lot of fun.
How were your teammates in the minor league as far as their attitudes and stuff were concerned? Was it pretty, were any of them really totally serious, or was it, you said, mostly just guys having some fun and, you know, looking to possibly play some major league ball?
All the guys are serious. They're all serious, but, you know, in the minor leagues, there's so much camaraderie. You know, everybody's broke. Everybody, you know, you're taking these 20, 22-hour bus rides, and everybody's goal is to get to the big leagues, and you look down, and you know there's only one or two, maybe three of you that are going to make it at AA. You know, you go to the same places after the games, same watering holes or whatever it may be. leagues, everybody stays at the same apartment complex, and there's, after every game, there's all the families get together and have barbecues, and minor leagues is a lot of fun. You know, it's a lot of fun and camaraderie, and a lot like college baseball, where, that you don't have as much in the big leagues.
Is there anything that stands out in your mind, any like off the wall or really humorous adventures or misadventures with you and your teammates in the time you spent in the minor leagues? Because you mentioned a couple of pretty, what I perceive as pretty wild cities. I know El Paso could be a lot of fun. I spent some time there doing some work. Anything that really sticks out in your mind?
Oh, man. Nothing comes to my mind. I know there's a million stories. If I started naming cities, probably half the stories I wouldn't be able to tell you. Gosh, I wish I would have had that question
a couple
days ago. I could have.
Alrighty, well, if anything comes to mind towards the end, maybe we'll go back on that. Alright, so you mentioned you had pretty much had a straight ahead and a pretty fast progression through the minor leagues. You went to training camp, I guess you said in 75 or 76 with the Angels.
75 is a non-roster.
Non-roster. When you were called up to the major leagues, was there any special circumstances surrounding that, or was it just they needed a pitcher and you were there at AAA ready to go?
It was kind of interesting how that happened. It was the 4th of July in Phoenix, and I had pitched the night before, and Jimmy Williams called me in and said, you're going to Anaheim, but you might not stay. What the heck is that? And he says, well, they have to sell a pitcher. They have to sell a pitcher. So I get to the stadium about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I fly in from Phoenix. Go to John Wayne Airport, and I get to the stadium at 2 o'clock, and I go up to Harry Dalton's office, and Harry says, you gotta leave, you can't stick around here. He goes, come back at 3 o'clock. So I left, I went to the park, I went to a little park in the area, and I came back at 3 o'clock, and he says, nothing's happened yet, you gotta leave. So as I'm walking out, I see Andy Hassler come in, and Andy says, what are you doing here? And I said, I don't know what I'm doing here. I said, they told me to come up that there might be a deal in the works. He goes, I think I'm that deal. Because they called him and told him to come in. What happened? They finally, they were waiting on that. Kansas City was going to purchase Andy Hassler's contract. But that's what happened. So that's kind of how Andy found out when he ran into me in the lobby.
Okay, so you got into the majors that first time around July 4th. Did you end up staying for any length of time, or is it right back?
No, I came up in July, and I stayed there through the second half of the season and did really well when I first came up. Had about 20 innings in, maybe about 9 games, and had a lot of strikeouts, had 1 or 2 walks, and was doing extremely well, had a couple saves. And then one day I pitched and had a bad game. I think it was about my 11th or 12th ball game. Didn't pitch well at all, and didn't pitch for a week. And Norm Sherry was my manager in AAA, and he had done the same thing for me. He had done the same thing to me the year before. slider on that on the last pitch, and I felt something in my elbow again. But it didn't really hurt. But the next morning, I woke up, and my whole elbow was swollen. And I went the next morning. They were making a trip to Kansas City and Chicago, and I came and told the trainer, you know, I said, my elbow hurts, and it's swollen. He looked at it and said, well, you got to go see the doctor. So in those days, they looked at it, gave you a cortisone shot, told you to take 3 days off, and threw you back in the ballgame. And that's exactly what they did. And I threw three innings against Chicago, but the cortisone has Novocaine in it. You don't feel it. So I went out that night, and I think that's when I really tore it, because I was in a lot of pain the day after that. That was like 4 days later after my elbow was swollen and everything. And so I had a lot of elbow problems, and that stayed with me like the last month of the season. And then I went to spring training in 77, bothered me again, and was traded to the White Sox. Went down to AAA, then went to AAA with the White Sox, then came up in September. But 78, same story, and it always bothered me. I couldn't, anytime I tried to throw a few breaking balls in a game, I'd have problems. And finally, in the winter of between the 78 and 79 season, I finally got it, the right treatment for it, and got it taken care of. And then I was fine, but the problem was I had lost my mechanics and velocity during that time. To take the strain off the elbow, I had really dropped down. I dropped down from three-quarters to sidearm to even lower than that. And you just can't throw hard from down there.
You mentioned that you basically were a sinker ball pitcher when you first came up. Is that how you would characterize your pitching style, more or less?
I was a sinker-slider pitcher, and I changed speeds off those two pitches. So I was primarily a two-pitch pitcher, but you could say three. I threw a changeup, changed up on the sinker, mostly.
How about your pitching motion? Tell me a little bit about it.
My pitching motion after I got hurt was described as watching me pitch is like watching a guy fall out of a tree. That's how one writer described it. And I didn't. I had a real funky, you know, right-handed motion where I threw across my body and kind of slinged the ball. And it was my primary role with the Twins in the early 80s was just to come in and get the right-hand hitters out in the middle innings. Left-handers gave me problems because I just had the sinker and I changed speed, but I had problems with left-handers. I didn't have problems with left-handers in the minors or in the big leagues when I first came up, because then I threw the ball probably 85 miles an hour and had a real hard sinker. But after I got hurt, my fastball was probably 79, 80. And now instead of the hard sinker, it was more of a rolling sinker. So I got banged around pretty good by the lefties. But I could always get right-handers out.
What was your basic pitching strategy then? It was just to
throw strikes.
Just throw strikes?
Throw strikes and make them hit the ball on the ground. And if I got in a situation where I got two strikes on a hitter, then I would try maybe for a strikeout. I'd maybe stay with the breaking ball a little more and try to strike the guy out.
So an 0-2 pitch, if you had that sort of setup, you would try to bunt the guy and try to get him swinging at something to strike him out?
0-2, I a lot of times I'd go way in 0-2, and then 1-2, come back with a breaking ball, or else maybe think he's looking breaking ball and try to catch the outside corner with a fastball.
You mentioned sinker. Was that your best pitch?
It was my best pitch, but my slider was my prettiest pitch, probably. It broke a lot. It broke pretty sharp. But my sinker, was probably my best pitch.
Did you throw that when you really needed a strike or an out? Is that when you pitched?
I threw them both. Uh-huh. When I really needed an out. A lot of times, if I needed a double play, if I was in a situation with runner on first, if I got two strikes, I would go with the sinker to get a ground ball rather than trying for a strikeout. You know, depending upon who the next hitter was. If the next hitter, say I had a runner on first and one out, and George Brett was the on-deck hitter. Well, I wouldn't try to strike the guy out, because why would I want to face George Brett? You know, or I even knew that if George came up, the lefty would be coming in. So I'd go, well, screw that. I'm going to get this guy in a double play, so maybe I'll get to be able to pitch to Brett. I just wanted to go the way that would move me the quickest. Once I had pitched, after I pitched a year or two of relief, I wouldn't have wanted to go back in the starting rotation. Because the good part about relief is you don't have to, you never know when you're going to play, so you treat every day the same. And I remember being a starter in college, I'd be pretty tense the day before, and then, you know, wouldn't sleep too well the night before. I'd get really tense. And usually as a starter, the day before and the day you're pitching is ruined. It's just ruined. And as a reliever, every day is the same. And I like that part of relieving, because you never knew whether you're going to pitch or not, so there's never anything to worry about, nothing to get tense about.
Did you have any special or superstitious habits that you kind of followed on game day as a relief pitcher, but anything out in the bullpen when you were warming up that you kind of adhered to that you thought was your lucky charm, anything like that?
No, I didn't have any superstitions at all. Didn't have any of those.
Played with two or three different teams in the big leagues. Who were some of the better catchers or who you felt were some of the better catchers you had a chance to play with?
Etchebarren was real good defensively. He was toward the end of his career when he caught me. And he couldn't throw as well toward the end of his career. Terry Humphrey was a catcher. Terry was real good defensively. He was fun to throw to. Terry made the game real fun. You know, things he'd say to you out of the mound, he was just real carefree. And Butch Weiniger I had in Minnesota. And Butch, pretty much, you called your own game. Butch just put the numbers down and you shook it yes or shook it no. And he wasn't, Butch is real quiet, wasn't a leader type. But defensively, he could throw well, and he was good defensively. The guy I would have really liked to have thrown to, and I think probably could have extended my career even longer, would have been Bob Boone. I would have really liked to have thrown to him, because I watched how he handled pitchers and how he framed those sinkers and how he worked. And I just think, boy, if I could have had a catcher like that, I might have stuck around longer. Not taking anything away from the other guys. Boone's one of them.
Were you the type of pitcher who would have preferred the catcher to be more involved, or did you like, as you said, calling your own game?
At the time, I liked calling my own game, but I look back on it, and it wasn't a good idea. I tended to be a little too conservative on the mound, and I'd go 0-2 a lot of times with the bases loaded, and I wouldn't even want to throw a ball in that situation. I'd keep going after, and that's dumb. I look back now, and it's kind of stupid. I should have done more pitching, and I wish the catcher would have taken a little more charge. But I notice that even though in college now, I started off being a year letting the pitchers pretty much do their own thing, and we were just taking a shellac. And now everything's pretty structured, and they have to do, they have to throw the pitch I want them to throw, and they can shake me, but they better have a real good reason to shake me between innings. They better tell me, what they're thinking.
What was your favorite ballpark to pitch in your trip through the majors?
Well, I can tell you the ones I hated. I hated the Yankee Stadium. And the reason I hated that place is because they had so many left-handed hitters. I hated pitching that ballpark to Oscar Gamble, and I hated pitching to Nettles, and I hated pitching to Jim Spencer and all those guys. That short porch, and Roy White, and any of them. It's just because every left-handed hitter that stood up there was a home run threat. So it was like pitching to every left-hander you face was like facing Babe Ruth in that ballpark. And I'd come in to face three righties, and I'd get three lefties every game. And my ERA at that place was probably 20-something. I didn't look forward to that. I didn't like pitching in Fenway because I didn't feel real comfortable when I'd see my left fielder playing about 5 feet behind the shortstop. That's not real comfortable. I remember the ballparks I hate. I like pitching in Anaheim. It was a fair park. I like pitching at nighttime because the ball didn't carry at all. As a sinker ball pitcher, I usually wasn't all that concerned about dimensions as much as I were what kind of infield it had, because I knew if I was on my game, I was going to get ground balls. I wasn't on my game. Then it all depended what ballpark it was. But I didn't care for Seattle because of the AstroTurf.
Stadium as being one of your least favorite places. Do you remember the first time you went in there? Because Yankee Stadium kind of has a special place for a lot of people. It's if Babe Ruth played there and all that sort of stuff. Do you remember your first outing?
My first outing there is just, it's one of the greatest games of all time. It was Frank Tanana had a two-hitter going into the bottom of the ninth inning. We were ahead 8-0. And there was one out and nobody on base, and he's got a two-hitter going. We were in the bullpen, and we had bagged all the balls, and that's bad luck. As soon as we got the first out, we just bagged all the balls, and I remember it was about 105 degrees that day, and we were miserable. It was just a sweltering day. And I remember when he got the first out, we had sodas back there, and I took two 12-ounce canned sodas, and I guzzled both of them as fast as I could. We were screwing our games over. Next guy, base hit, walk, air, base hit, bing, bing, phone rings. Get Verhoeven up. So I'm ready to throw up. But I'm up throwing, and my stomach is sticking over my belt because I've just guzzled these two sodas, just guzzled them, and I'm just sick to my stomach, and I've got all this carbonation. And now I'm warming up, and it's an 8-2 ball game. There's a couple men on, but I'm not too worried yet. Tanana's pitching. He doesn't get anybody. He gets that one first batter out. I go into the ballgame. The score is now 8-4. There's runners on second and third and one out still. So I come in, and the first batter I face is Thurman Munson. And Thurman, I should backtrack. I get into the car. This car is about 140 degrees inside this car. And it's a car that takes you from the bullpen. And I start to roll down the window, and as I roll down the window, the guy driving the car grabs my hand and says, "Roll that window up." And I quick roll the window up, and all of a sudden, a beer and a hot dog and mustard and popcorn and another beer, because we're going right along the left field line, and they're just pulverizing this car with everything. It's bat day. There's 55,000 people there. It's on a bat day. And they're losing 8-0, or now it's 8-4, and they're starting to get excited. So by the time this thing drops me off, this car just looked like it had mustard all over it. So I go out, and the first batter is Munson, and Thurman lines out to the left fielder. And he hits it so hard that they can't even tag. They don't want to make it. He doesn't try to tag. So the next batter up is Carlos May, left-handed hitter. And Carlos hits a ground ball to second base to Jerry Remy. And on the second hop, it hits the area between the dirt and the grass, and it kangaroos over his head, and the score is now 8-6 and a runner on first. Roy White comes up and hits a second pitch. It hits a second pitch over the right field fence. 8-8 ball game. So Tanana ended up winning 19 games that year. 19 games he won, and to this day he still blames me for not winning. He says his only shot for 20 wins, and I cost him. He still blames it on me every time, and I see Frank at least two or three times a year. Every time he sees me, he introduces me as the guy that cost him 20. But that was my first appearance, and it went nothing but downhill from there.
That's a great story. Did any other ballpark have any special significance for you? Anything else career-wise, or you just felt good about it, anything like that? You had mentioned Anaheim, but any of the other ballparks?
I remember one of the reasons I got traded to Minnesota. I was with the White Sox in September, and I came up and I threw three innings against the Twins, and Gene Mock was managing. I threw three innings and faced nine hitters, and I had 4 putouts and 4 assists of the 9 batters I faced, and I remember that was exciting for me because that was my first appearance in the big league since early in the year in 1977. And that appearance right there helped me get traded to the Twins and got me back in the big leagues a couple more years. Because Mock had told me that, because remember that night when you threw against us? And of course I had forgotten it. He hadn't either.
When you first came up with the Angels, you pretty much were like a hometown boy coming out of Long Beach. What was it like pitching in Anaheim Stadium for the first time when he came up into the big leagues? Is that a special moment for you?
Yeah, it was really exciting. Really exciting. people. I remember coming in, it was bases loaded, two outs, and we were losing at the time. And the hitter was George Hendrick. And George was leading the American League in home runs at that time. And he had 19 home runs, and this was the first part of July. And I remember that warming up, I was so nervous that I was throwing the ball at half speed when I was warming up, because I knew if I threw it like I could, that the ball was going to go on top of that screen that goes up over Anaheim Stadium. So I wouldn't even throw the ball, and the first pitch I threw, I knocked him right on his butt. I wasn't trying to at all. I was trying to throw a strike, and I ended up throwing it right at George's head. And that's probably the best thing I could have done at that time, because I ended up getting him out, and I ended up facing him probably 8 or 9 more times in my career, and he never got hit. So I always got him in double plays, because he always remembered me as that wild right-hander. So that I just remember my knees never knocking like that ever again.
Once the novelty wore off, did you feel that it was something that was helpful to you, or was there other outside distractions, kind of pitching in your hometown?
The only distractions was the tickets. Uh-huh. That was a distraction. I remember we had an apartment in Anaheim, pretty close to the stadium, and I remember changing our phone number once during the season because it would ring constantly for the tickets. That was the biggest problem. Other than that, it was great. And I remember changing our phone again in the winter.
Any umpires, John, that stood out in your mind for either good or bad reasons that you really recall? Any umpire that
I hated Luciano.
Really?
I absolutely hated Luciano because in a spring training game, I knew him and Sal Bandit were tight, and I was battling to make the club in 77. I was in spring training, and Sal Bandit was up, and I was pitching against Milwaukee at Sun City, and there was a couple men on base, and I'm battling to make the club, and I threw first pitch, strike right down the middle, ball one. So I gave him just kind of one of those looks, like, you know, I don't think I even gave him a look. I just kind of caught the ball and went back. Next pitch, I put it right there. He goes ball two. So I look at him now, and I'm going, now I don't say a word. I'm just looking at him like, what do I got to do? So the next pitch, I throw another strike, and now the count's 3-0. And now I'm upset. I'm hollering at him, you know. I say something to him, and you don't say anything to the umpire, especially when you're just a young guy. He's only been in the big leagues half a year. And from that point on, I hated Luciano. It just really ticked me off that here I am trying to make a club, and these guys, you know, these guys don't think anything about it. They'll stick it to the young player, and the young player is a guy that needs help. And they do the same thing now when, you know, when you face Crew and the game on the line. If you had a young pitcher out there, you had to literally lay the ball in there. And that part makes me mad because those guys don't need any help. They don't need any help, especially against some young pitcher out there, you know, battling like crazy to just stay up there. Those guys don't need any help. And to this day, I don't like Luciano for that.
So, overall, would you categorize the quality of umpiring as fairly decent in the big leagues, I mean?
Oh, yeah, it's overall? Good. It's good umpiring. Yeah. They're consistent. You'd get guys, I remember Ed Brinkman. You know, he wouldn't give me my low sinker, and I knew that after two or three games when he wouldn't give it to you, then you know, I'll only throw my low sinker when I know they're swinging, but if they're not swinging, I'll go to the breaking ball or bring it up just a little bit, and then if I get ahead, then I'll go back to my thing. But at least they were consistent, you know.
Is that what you as a pitcher really look for from them, is the consistency, so you can figure out where they are, and then you can kind of adjust yourself to fit their style?
And hopefully they'll be the same way the next time you see them, because in relief, you know, you just, as a reliever, usually the umpire is the farthest thing from your mind, because you're going in and it's crucial situations. You try to think back now, let's see, okay, who's behind the plate. I would try to be aware before the game. You wouldn't be able to think of it during the game, but before the game, I'd see who was behind the plate. I'd check and go, oh yeah, that's Shulak. Yeah, Shulak gives me the breaking ball in the outside corner. At least he did last time. Well, let me see if he does the same thing. And then boom, if he'll go right away, great. I got him back there. He's the same way. He's consistent.
Who were the toughest hitters for you to face when you were up in the big leagues, and why?
the hitters that gave me trouble were the left-handed hitters who could go the other way. I didn't have a whole lot of trouble with the power hitting left-handers because I knew they were going to try to pull me. And if you tried to pull me as a left-hander, you were doing me a favor because I didn't make too many mistakes. If I made a mistake, I'd give up a home run, but I didn't give up too many. But the hitters that gave me trouble were the guys that could go the other way, the Carews and guys, Miguel Delaney, and you know, guys that you, Mike Hargrove, and just the singles type hitters that would take you to left field. You know, those guys gave me a real bad time.
You mentioned before that during your high school career and in college, after you had played basketball, that you experienced some arm trouble. Why do you think that today's pitchers can't throw 250-plus innings? Is it would you relate it directly to not to arm trouble, not preparing properly?
Boy, that's a tough one. A lot of the things I see with the kids is that when we played ball. I mean, we played it a lot. And if I wasn't throwing a baseball, I was throwing a football. And kids now are, you see a lot of soccer where they don't throw much. During the baseball season, they won't really work on their pitching. They won't do a whole lot of throwing. They don't develop any arm strength at a young age. Everybody's so worried, oh, he's going to hurt his arm, he's going to hurt his arm, I don't want him to pitch. And the kids that hurt their arm when they're young are the kids that are throwing every day. The kids that are throwing three times a week and they throw year-round, those kids don't get hurt. It's not throwing year-round that hurts you. It's throwing 6 months, throwing a lot for 6 months, and then not picking up anything and throwing anything for 6 months. That'll get you hurt. You know, the pitchers you see from Latin America, those guys that never get hurt. There's always the white guys that got, there's always the gringos and the American guys, you know. And the Latin players never got hurt. Because they're always throwing year-round. You know, they're always throwing year-round.
What do you think about this controversy that seems to have erupted in baseball the last couple of years about pitchers unable to come inside, hitters taking a bit of umbrage to it? Do you feel that a pitcher has to come inside to be effective, and did you have any trouble coming inside?
A pitcher has to come inside to be effective. I'm totally convinced of that. I lived inside as a pitcher. I would throw the ball in a lot, with the sinker especially. You know, I wasn't a power pitcher, but my sinker, I would start it off inside and try to get it in their hands to the righties. And occasionally I would go in on left-handers. But that's the number one thing I stress now as a coach here at Dominguez. I tell them, if you can't pitch inside, you're not going to be able to pitch in college. And so, even if guys use metal bats, you can still jam them. You can still get in the guy's kitchen. And that's the number one thing we talk about here. If you can't pitch inside, you're not going to win. If you're afraid to pitch inside, you get a dog. Bring a German Shepherd out to the mound with you. And obviously you can't do that. So then you might as well get another position. Because if you're not going to pitch inside, you're not going to pitch at Cal State Dominguez.
Yeah.
Because and that's what we were not doing in the beginning of the year that we started doing and made a big difference, pitching inside. The outside half of the plate belongs to the pitcher. The inside half of the plate belongs to the hitter. But the only way you get the outside half of the plate, the only way you're going to get the outside half of the plate, the only way the hitter's going to give it to you is you have to show that hitter that you'll try to take his half away. But if you don't try to take his inside half away once in a while, he's going to take your outside half away.
Once that you got up into the big leagues, who had the most influence on you overall? Was there anybody in particular that stands out?
After I got to the big leagues.
Is there any like player who maybe took you under their wing? You had mentioned Nolan Ryan, you were thrown around. Did you have any of that sort of interaction with someone like him who had been around a while, or was there anybody that kind of you anything like that?
Yeah, Jerry Kuzman did. Jerry Kuzman always treated me like a guy that was equal to him, which it wasn't, of course. And I always appreciated that. And I talk to Jerry probably twice a year. I'll call him, he'll call me. And we've stayed in contact with each other since 81. It's been 10 years now that we played together. We played together in 80 and 81. And he was pretty special to me because, you know, he was a veteran and he pitched in 1960. You know, I watched him throw a shutout at Dodger Stadium when I was probably 13 or 14 years old. And he always treated me like a guy who'd been in the big leagues as long as him. You know, he's that type of guy.
You had mentioned Jimmy Williams. Gene, I guess we had him when he was in Minnesota.
Gene
that was Gene's downfall, is how he dealt not with his number one reliever and his number one or two and three starter and his five starters, whatever. It's how he dealt with the number six, seven, eight, nine, and tenth man on the pitching staff. It was like non-existent. And that was Gene's downfall. Gene was his strategies were fun. I mean, it was fun. He would sit before a game, and I'd like to sit and listen to him. He would say, today in this game in the ninth inning, so-and-so is going to be pitching. We're going to be up by a run, or we're going to be down by one run, and I'm going to pinch hit Goodwin, and he's going to get a base hit because Goodwin hit that. He had the whole game mapped out before it ever started, and more times than not, I can remember, and the manager from the other team would play right into Gene's hand. Gene would always have what he wanted going in the ninth inning, but he didn't have the horses. He just didn't have the horses. But if Gene Mock would have turned over his pitching staff to, if he would have had a real good pitching coach, you know, somebody who he had confidence in and somebody he trusted, if he would have turned over several of his teams to his pitching coach, he probably would have won several World Series championships by now. I don't, there's no doubt in my mind that if he would have just turned it loose, if he'd have had like a Marcel Lachman,
yeah,
like who's there now.
What about Billy Gardner? Did he have a major league pitcher also?
I don't think so. I think he was an
infielder also.
Yeah. Okay.
See, did he have anything that he any wisdom that he imparted to you at all, or?
Billy was he was pretty funny. Billy didn't like me at all. He did not like my personality.
What was it like dealing with Calvin Griffith, the owner of the Twins?
So you knew that you know, you're going to have to fight for every. If you wanted a $5,000 raise, you're going to have to go in and fight for it. But Calvin was fair. He'd make you fight for it. You'd say, give me $5,000. He'd say, hey, you ain't even worth what we're offering you. He'd get right back in your face. But you know, he didn't have it. He didn't have the money to throw out. It was a family-run business. He was the last of the Mohegans.
As a pitcher, you came up late 70s. Was the DH already in effect when you came into the big leagues? So
yeah.
You never got a chance to hit the big leagues?
No.
Did you like to hit though as a pitcher? Was that something you would have liked to have done?
No.
No?
I would rather pull weeds all day than hit. I hated it. Only thing hitting got me was sore hands. I'd either get jammed or hit off the end of my bat.
What, as a pitching coach today, what do you think is the most important thing that you pass along to the kids that you deal with?
Number one is pitching inside. That's number one. The other thing is getting ahead. I should turn around. Number one, getting ahead. We talk about getting ahead. We throw first pitch fastball probably 90% of the time. And the other teams know it. And I want them to know it. A lot of times, I'll play with the hitter. I'll holler out, fastball. I'll holler out. So they know the fastball's coming. Because we want the guy swinging, especially if nobody on base. I'll holler out fastball just to play with the hitter a little bit. So he knows he's getting the fastball. And the fourth time up, he knows he's getting the fastball, but I want the ball to be put in play because most first ball swingers are not good hitters. Very few first ball hitters are good hitters. So, and you want to put the ball in play. I would much rather have a reputation. This kid throws strikes, comes after you, he'll throw fastball first pitch, get up there hacking. Because, boy, that's when you get those five, six pitch innings. And as a pitcher, you have to have some of those. You know, you have to have some of those games. We just had a game out here 3 weeks ago where my starter threw a perfect game and he threw 80 pitches.
Wow.
He threw 80 pitches and he struck out, I believe, two. And he threw first pitch fastball probably out of 27 hitters. He threw first pitch fastball 23 times probably. That was a great game to watch, and it was like an hour and a half.
So you agree more with Ray Miller, I think it is, who says work fast, change speed, and get ahead. I think that's basic playbook philosophy. You agree
number
with
one, number one, I stress, get ahead. Number two, pitch inside. And number three, work quickly. Those are the three things that I stress. Sounds pretty.
who are the players, John, today that you would pay to go to the stadium to see? guys do you really enjoy watching when you either go out by yourself or with your friends, your family, whatever?
I really watch. I love to watch Canseco hit. I love to watch him hit. And his swings. His swings are just monstrous. And he's one of the. He's probably the greatest talent that's ever played baseball. I don't think there's any doubt. I mean, you look at his physical size, and you look at how he runs, and you look at his strength and as far as he hits the ball. And, he's fun to watch. You know, I can be at a game and be looking at reading an article out of the program, but if I hear Canseco right away, I'll put the hot dog down. I'll put the program down. And I'll watch Canseco hit. You don't want to miss him. It's kind of like Reggie was in the late 70s. You know, you'd always watch Reggie hit when I was in Minnesota. Reggie came up, you would watch that whole AB. You wouldn't miss a pitch from that particular AB. As far as pitchers, I love watching Eckersley pitch. He's the epitome of a relief pitcher. He's got the attitude, you know, he's just got that look on his face like, get up there and hurry up so I can get you out, so you can get out of here, you know. I love watching Eckersley pitch. I like watching his face, and I just like watching his actions around the mound, and you know, he's arrogant, cocky, and he's just fun, you know. He can give up, you can see him, he can go up and give a crucial hit, shrugging his shoulders, getting the ball back to the umpire. You know, it's just the whole makeup that Eckersley has. I guess those two guys.
In your career, you played with some teams that struggled, with the exception of the White Sox, and you didn't really play with them too long. I take it that year they finished third. Do you feel that had a negative effect on your career?
Not really. Maybe that's probably why I was on those clubs. That might have been why I was on them, because I was, you know, at best, I was an average major league pitcher, an average major league relief pitcher at best. You know, so there might have been, it would have been fun to play on contenders, but I don't know, maybe I wasn't good enough. I always felt that was at the time. You know, I thought, hey, I'd like to play with a contender and getting some ball games that, you know, would be where the pennant would be on the line. God, that would be fun, you know, but it just wasn't meant to be.
You had some teammates that had some big names throughout the course of your career, guys like Bobby Bonds and Frank Tanana, and you said Nolan, and people like that. Any really things that stand out in your mind that besides, you know, that really made them special? What do you think that made some of those guys special? You mentioned Eckersley's arrogance and stuff, the way he went about it. Was it the same sort of thing with those guys?
Yeah, Tanana. Tanana had that air about him. You know, what was fun to watch about Tanana is, like, there'd be nobody on base, and Frank would be, he'd be in first, and he'd just be like in first gear, and he'd get this look on his face. He had the same look Eckersley has, and then all of a sudden, he'd give up a couple base hits, and his facial expression would change. His fastball would start jumping out of his hand instead of just kind of coming out of his hand, and he could really crank it up, man. He would switch gears, and he'd get in trouble. He would switch gears, like, just at the snap of a finger, and that was always fun to watch, you know, because the only way you could beat Tanana when he was with the Angels, the only way you could beat him was to hit a home run. Where there wasn't men in scoring position, you could beat him. Runner on first, two outs, he'd have a 1-0 lead, and he might give up a home run and get beat 2-1, because we didn't score any runs. We never scored. And that's the only way you were gonna beat Frank. Nolan, the thing I remember about Nolan was his stubbornness. He was so stubborn. We played a game in Detroit, and he was ahead 2-1, and it was the bottom of the ninth inning, and they had a runner on second base and two outs. And Jason Thompson was a rookie that year. He was a left-hand hitter, and he was a rookie. And Norm Sherry had been managing the club for about less than a week. It had been 4 or 5 days. He had just taken over for Dick Williams because it was my first or second road trip. And Norm said, and he figures Nolan didn't see it, right? So he goes like this, and Nolan, with his cock, head cock, get down like that. So Terry gets down, and he ends up going ball one. So Norm now is screaming. He's screaming from the dugout, put him on, put him on. Nolan won't put him on. Terry stands up again and holds his glove out. And Terry calls timeout and goes out to talk to Nolan and says, hey, we've got to put him on. You know, Norm wants to put him on. Well, apparently, whatever Nolan said to him, he goes, I ain't going to put on no rookie. Okay? So Terry goes back there, and Norm's hollering, so Terry just gets down on the crowd because Norm hasn't come out to the mound. You know, he figures, you know. So to make a short story long, he ends up walking Thompson anyway.
John, thanks a lot. It was really a lot of fun talking to you. Good luck in the future. Bye.
After the bottom of the eighth, we still have a 2-1 lead, and the phone rings, and I pick up the phone because I'm sitting right by it, and Norm screams in the phone, Gabaroo! He screams, and he hangs up the phone. So I start throwing out. I go in the ballgame. What he did is